Thank you for listening to the Resources for Integrated Care podcast series, Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities and Behavioral Health, Leveraging Person-Centered Approaches. This podcast is excerpted from a webinar presented live on September 27th, 2023. In this podcast, John Jansa, a senior consultant at the Lewin Group, facilitates a panel discussion with Dr. Andrea Whitwer, associate professor at the Ohio State University Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health, and the director of training and outreach at the Neisonger Center, University Center for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities, Olivia Ayers, clinical director at Elevate, a certified community behavioral health clinic, and Dr. Patricia Noby, a family caregiver with experience in state, congressional, federal, and private sectors. During this discussion, panelists discuss strategies health plans can use to bridge gaps in existing systems to meet the ongoing care needs of dually eligible individuals through interdisciplinary care teams and support for family and caregivers of individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities and behavioral health conditions.
We will now move into our panel discussion and will welcome Dr. Pat Noby. In addition to our esteemed speakers, my colleague John Jansa is joining to facilitate the panel discussion and audience Q&A. John, I will turn things over to you.
Thank you very much, Leslie. Perfect. The first question for you, Dr. Noby, what kind of support do family members or caregivers who support an individual with IDD and a behavioral health condition need?
Thank you, John. So families need consistency, and individuals with IDD and a behavioral health condition need a predictable routine. When that routine fails, the care and support falls on the family. Consistency means knowing who is supporting them outside of the family and that those support people really know the individual. The other thing I think caregivers need is crisis prevention strategies and training, so they can avoid escalation of the incident, which could result in an inpatient or ED transfer, or worse, having to call the police. Effective communication is part of all of this.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Noby. And again, this question is for you, Dr. Noby. How can a plan or a health plan integrate family and caregivers into an individual's care team? And also, how can that plan support the entire care team?
Great. So family members or the primary unpaid caregiver are part of the care team. Planning cannot proceed without them. Particularly for individuals with a communication challenge, the family caregiver is the proxy for information. For example, when my daughter Mia was hospitalized this winter, she got asked with every clinical contact, "What is your pain level on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being no pain?" And she would always say 10. Because in her understanding, there was either pain or no pain. But I knew she wasn't on level 10 pain, which would have required a heavy painkiller prescription, which she did not need. I had to educate the clinicians on how to ask that question or interpret it differently. That's not to say that people with IDD and a behavioral health condition have no agency. They do, and the task for the care team is to support that agency in decision-making as much as possible, drawing on the knowledge that the family caregiver has about the individual's situation. Technically speaking, if a person has a Medicaid home and community-based setting service or support, they are able to invite whoever they want to a care plan meeting. This may provide another perspective because families can sometimes limit a person's opportunities out of concern for their health or safety.
Thank you, Dr. Noby. Thank you so much for sharing those insights. So this question is for all three of the panelists. In your experience, what is the most helpful action a health plan can take to support individuals with IDD and a behavioral health condition and their support network? And again, Dr. Noby, we'll begin with you.
So I think the most important thing is to listen. The individual and their family and or their care partners have a history and an experience that preceded health plan involvement. Either they have learned to adapt or they will need support to learn ways to accommodate the needs of the individual differently. But what they have lived is helpful to the care coordinators to build on, and also use modes of communication that work for the individual.
Thank you, Dr. Noby. Dr. Whitwer, do you mind offering your perspective on this?
Yeah, sure. I think it's helpful for care plans to provide time for the team of care providers to meet. Also, we know that things like patient navigators can be incredibly helpful in these instances.
Now, thank you, Dr. Whitworth. And Olivia, how would you like to add to the response for this question?
Yeah, I think a biopsychosocial approach is really crucial. So explore biopsychosocial vulnerabilities and potential reasoning for changes in functioning or the behavior. Consider the individual's abilities and their vulnerabilities. So the individual's cognitive and adaptive functioning, their communication abilities, mental health functioning are all important aspects of the person to ensure that we are incorporating those. And goals should be truly person-centered and achievable based on their current functioning. In conjunction, health plans should consider the current system members and especially the primary caregivers to ensure what is being asked is doable for the current system's functioning and that the system feels supported through those recommendations and changes.
Great. Thank you all. So the fourth panel question is for all three of you again. What are the key indicators, such as environmental, physical, or behavioral, that could prompt action to prevent adverse outcomes, or prevent ER utilization or inpatient hospitalization, and address social determinants of health? And Dr. Noby, you're free to go ahead first.
Thanks, John. So if an individual has a behavior support plan, then indicators can be set for elements of that plan. And if an incident, a behavioral incident, exceeds that indicator or gets close, then other interventions or actions need to take place. For example, you know, learning what environmental incidents trigger a behavioral crisis and learning how to de-escalate that incident or experience might prevent any de-utilization or an inpatient stay. The Council on Quality and Leadership did a study on the relationship between ongoing staff development and the incidence of the things mentioned here, adverse outcomes, ED utilization, et cetera. More staff development, the lower the incidence of adverse events, such as accidents, falls, abuse and neglect, ED utilization, and medication errors. They've also found a positive relationship between individuals being able to choose where to live and having robust community supports to less adverse incidents and where social determinants of health have an impact on their quality of life. These studies are more about the relationships of paid staff to the individuals that they support, but the experiences that were studied also encompass what family caregivers do, and these are indicators that should be considered.
Thank you, Dr. Noby. Dr. Whitworth, do you mind sharing your thoughts on these strategies?
Yeah, in order to identify those key indicators, it's important to ensure that the team identify early any changes in behavior. We want to also look for changes in engagement and activities of living or mood, and we want the team to be sure to communicate changes to the treatment planning team. It's also key to have a way to track behavior and other side effects to minimize adverse medication outcomes of side effects of those medications. We also want the team to take into account the individual's environment, their access to social engagement, and other activities that promote healthy living. Be sure to take into account any adverse experiences in the person's life and realize that many of the things that we don't think of as traumatic may be experienced as such by individuals with IDD.
Thank you so much, Dr. Whitworth. Olivia, I'll turn it over to you for your response.
Yeah, I think just to add what's been shared already, knowing that individual's baseline through that biopsychosocial lens is really helpful. Data tracking is so important. So looking, we call it ABC tracking. So looking at that and exceeded the behavior and the consequence. So what happened before, during, and after an incident can really help us to assess the changes and contribute to that are contributing to those behaviors. And that's what's going to help us to plan in the future for what we're going to do next time. Tracking things that could impact them biopsychosocially, like if we're serving an individual that has had constipation concerns in the past and that's led to tertiary services, we might need to do some bowel movement tracking. And then the other thing I'll say about tracking is as much detail as possible is best for all data gathered. And it's really important that if you have a lot of different staff, that they're all tracking that data in the same manner. So set a very detailed and clear explanation of what's being tracked. Make the data tracker as easy to use as possible so that staff are able to use that there's a lot of work that can be done during the development of the tracker that really saves the staff a lot of time. And this is so helpful for physicians and prescribers of medication to assess what the next best steps are.
Thank you so much. Again, directed to all three of our panelists, can you talk about how community-based organizations support meeting the needs of individuals with IDD and a behavioral health diagnosis? Again, Dr. Nobe, we'll start with your response.
Yes, thanks. So social isolation has been talked about as equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes every day. It's considered a significant health risk. It's also a safety risk. All people need connections, and community-based organizations, including faith communities, can support the individual and their families and caregivers to develop connections outside the home. My daughter works, she goes to swimming, she bowls, she attends church and helps with a Sunday school class, and she has a social life with a group of adults that does various activities once a month. And she does all of this without me. If Mia doesn't show up in any of these places where she is expected, someone is calling or texting me to ask where she is and is she okay. Her being out and about in the community is an important part of her health and safety.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nobe, for sharing that. Dr. Whitworth, do you mind sharing your thoughts?
Sure, and just really building on what Dr. Nobe has said, there are a number of community-based supports that adults with IDD can use. These can help to promote positive mental health, as she illustrated, looking at things like meaningful employment, community engagement, and social connectedness.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Whitworth. And Olivia, I'll turn it to you for your response to this question.
Yes, thank you. The system coming together to offer support, brainstorm, and make decisions together is a really important way to support the individual that's being served. Being attuned is also a key way that the community organizations are supporting. So being attuned to changes in baseline helps the team identify those early warning signs that something's not quite right and action can be taken proactively. Being open and curious, so think through a biopsychosocial lens to mitigate the overshadowing of vulnerabilities. And finally, creativity is crucial for community organizations supporting this population. Creativity is important for meeting everyone's needs with the resources that they have available to them. So creativity is also important for incorporating things like that PERMA Plus model that we talked about and ensuring that PERMA for each individual being served is incorporated to their daily life.
Thank you for listening. This podcast is presented by the Lewin Group and is supported through the Medicare-Medicaid Coordination Office at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. MMCO is dedicated to helping beneficiaries enrolled in Medicare and Medicaid have access to seamless, high-quality healthcare that includes the full range of covered services in both programs. To support providers in their efforts to deliver more integrated, coordinated care, MMCO is developing technical assistance and actionable tools based on successful innovations and care models. To learn more about current efforts and resources, please visit our website, www.resourcesforintegratedcare.com. You can also find us on Twitter. Our handle is @integrate_care, or follow Resources for Integrated Care on LinkedIn to stay up to date with our recent products and technical assistance.